I replied cautiously. This was obviously not the chambermaid with my breakfast. Neither was it likely to be one of the other employees of the establishment, being evidently male, though very young. He seemed vaguely familiar, though I was sure I hadn't seen him before. I pulled the sheet a bit higher over my breasts. "And who are you?" I inquired. The head thought this over for some time, and finally answered with equal caution, "Ian Murray." "Ian Murray!" I shot up straight, rescuing the sheet at the last moment. "Come in here," I said peremptorily. "If you're who I think you are, why aren't you where you're supposed to be, and what are you doing here?" The face looked rather alarmed and showed signs of withdrawal. "Stop!" I called, and put a leg out of bed to pursue him. The big brown eyes widened at the sight of my bare limb, and he froze. "Come in," I said. Slowly I withdrew the leg beneath the quilts, and equally slowly he followed it into the room. He was tall and gangly as a fledgling stork, with perhaps 9 stones spread sparsely over a 6-foot frame. Now that I knew who he was, the resemblance to his father was clear. He had his mother's pale skin, though, which blushed furiously red as it occurred to him suddenly that he was standing next to a bed containing a naked woman.
I was looking for Mr. Malcolm, I mean, he murmured, staring fixedly at the floorboards by his feet.
If you mean your Uncle Jamie, he's not here, I said.
No, I suppose not.
He seemed unable to think of anything to add to this, but remained staring at the floor, 1 foot twisted awkwardly to the side, as though he were about to draw it up under him, like the wading bird he so much resembled.
"Do you ken where?"
he began, lifting his eyes. Then, as he caught a glimpse of me, lowered them, blushed again, and fell silent.
"He's looking for you," I said.
"With your father," I added. "They left here not half an hour ago." His head snapped up on its skinny neck, goggling.
"My father," he gasped. "My father was here. You knew him?"
"Why, yes," I said, without thinking. "I've known Ian for quite a long time." He might be Jamie's nephew, but he hadn't Jamie's trick of inscrutability. Everything he thought showed on his face, and I could easily trace the progression of his expressions. Raw shock at learning of his father's presence in Edinburgh, then a sort of awestruck horror at the revelation of his father's long-standing acquaintance with what appeared to be a woman of a certain occupation, and finally, the beginnings of angry absorption as the young man began an immediate revision of his opinions of his father's character.
I said, mildly alarmed. "It isn't what you think. I mean, your father and I... It's really your uncle and I. I mean..."
I was trying to figure out how to explain the situation to him without getting into even deeper waters when he whirled on his heel and started for the door.
"Wait a minute," I said.
He stopped, but didn't turn around. His well-scrubbed ears stood out like tiny wings, the morning light illuminating their delicate pinkness.
"How old are you?" I asked.
He turned around to face me with a certain painful dignity.
"I'll be 15 in 3 weeks," he said.
The red was creeping up his cheeks again.
"Dunna worry. I'm old enough to know what sort of place this is, I mean."
He jerked his head toward me in an attempt at a courtly bow.
"Meaning no offence to you, mistress. If Uncle Jamie, I mean I..."
He groped for suitable words, failed to find any, and finally blurted,
"Very pleased to meet you, mum,"
turned and bolted through the door, which shut hard enough to rattle in its frame. I fell back against the pillows, torn between amusement and alarm. I did wonder what the elder Ian was going to say to his son when they met, and vice versa. As long as I was wondering, I wondered what had brought the younger Ian here in search of Jamie. Evidently he knew where his uncle was likely to be found. Yet, judging from his diffident attitude, he had never before ventured into the brothel. Had he extracted the information from Geordie at the print shop? That seemed unlikely. And yet, if he hadn't,
Then that meant he had learned of his uncle's connection with this place from some other source. And the most likely source was Jamie himself. But in that case, I reasoned, Jamie likely already knew that his nephew was in Edinburgh. So why pretend he hadn't seen the boy? Ian was Jamie's oldest friend. They had grown up together. If whatever Jamie was up to was worth the cost of deceiving his brother-in-law, it was something serious. I had got no further with my musings when there came another knock on the door. "Come in," I said, smoothing out the quilts in anticipation of the breakfast tray to be placed thereon. When the door opened, I had directed my attention at a spot about 5 feet above the floor where I expected the chambermaid's head to materialize. Upon the last opening of the door, I had had to adjust my vision upward a foot to accommodate the appearance of young Ian. This time, I was obliged to drop it. "What in the bloody hell are you doing here?" I demanded as the diminutive figure of Mr. Willoughby entered on hands and knees. I sat up and hastily tucked my feet underneath me, pulling not only sheet but quilts well up around my shoulders. In answer, the Chinese advanced to within a foot of the bed, then let his head fall to the floor with a loud clunk. He raised it and repeated the process with great deliberation, making a horrid sound like a melon being cleaved with an axe. "Stop that!" I exclaimed as he prepared to do it a third time. "Thousand apology," he explained, sitting up on his heels and blinking at me. He was quite a bit the worse for wear, and the dark red mark where his forehead had smacked the floor didn't add anything to his appearance. I trusted he didn't mean he'd been going to hit his head on the floor 1,000 times, but I wasn't sure. He obviously had the hell of a hangover. For him to have attempted it even once was impressive. "That's quite all right," I said, edging cautiously back against the wall. "There's nothing to apologize for."
"Yes, apology," he insisted. "Samey saying wife. Lady being most honourable first wife, not stinking whore."
"Thanks a lot," I said. "Samey, you mean Jamie. Jamie Fraser." The little man nodded to the obvious detriment of his head. He clutched it with both hands and closed his eyes, which promptly disappeared into the creases of his cheeks.
"Samey," he affirmed, eyes still closed. "Samey saying apology to most honoured first wife. Yi Chang Chao, most humble servant."
He bowed deeply, still holding on to his head.
"Yi Chang Chao,"
he added, opening his eyes and tapping his chest to indicate that that was his name, in case I should be confusing him with any other humble servants in the vicinity.
"That's quite all right," I said. "Pleased to meet you."
Evidently heartened by this, he slid bonelessly onto his face, prostrating himself before me.
"Yi Chang Chao's lady's servant," he said. "First wife, pleased to walk on humble servant, if like."
"Ha ha," I said coldly. "I've heard about you. Walk on you, eh? Not bloody likely." A slit of gleaming black eye showed, and he giggled so irrepressibly that I couldn't help laughing myself. He sat up again, smoothing down the spikes of dirt-stiffened black hair that sprang, porcupine-like, from his skull.
"I wash first wife's feet?" he offered, grinning widely.
"Certainly not," I said. "If you really want to do something helpful, go and tell someone to bring me breakfast."
"No."
"Wait a minute," I said, changing my mind. "First, tell me where you met Jamie. If you don't mind," I added, to be polite. He sat back on his heels, head bobbing slightly.
"Docks," he said. 2 year ago. I come China. Long way. No food. Hiding barrel," he explained, reaching his arms in a circle to demonstrate his means of transportation.
"A stowaway?"
"Trade ship," he nodded. "On docks here, stealing food. Stealing brandy one night, getting stinking drunk. Very cold to sleep. Die soon, but see me find."
He jabbed a thumb at his chest once more.
"Same as humble servant. Humble servant, first wife.
He bowed to me, swaying alarmingly in the process, but came upright again without mishap.
Brandy seems to be your downfall, I observed. I'm sorry I haven't anything to give you for your head. I don't have any medicines with me at the moment.
Oh, not worry, he assured me. I having healthy balls.
How nice for you, I said, trying to decide whether he was gearing up for another attempt on my feet, or merely still too drunk to distinguish basic anatomy. Or perhaps there was some connection in Chinese philosophy between the well-being of head and testicles.
Just in case, I looked round for something that might be used as a weapon, in case he showed a disposition to begin burrowing under the bedclothes. Instead, he reached into the depths of one baggy blue silk sleeve, and with the air of a conjurer, drew out a small white silk bag. He upended this, and two balls dropped out into his palm. They were larger than marbles and smaller than baseballs, about the size, in fact, of the average testicle. A good deal harder, though, being apparently made of some kind of polished stone, greenish in colour.
Healthy balls, Mr. Willoughby explained, rolling them together in his palm.
They made a pleasant clicking noise.
Streaked jade from Canton, he said. Best kind of healthy balls.
Really? I said, fascinated.
And they're medicinal?
Good for you, that's what you're saying.
He nodded vigorously, then stopped abruptly with a faint moan. After a pause, he spread out his hand and rolled the balls to and fro, keeping them in movement with a dexterous circling of his fingers.
All body one part, hand all parts, he said.
He poked a finger toward his open palm, touching delicately here and there between the smooth green spheres.
Head there, stomach there, liver there, he said. Balls make all good.
Well, I suppose they're as portable as Alka-Seltzer, I said.
Possibly it was the reference to stomach that caused my own to emit a loud growl at this point.
First wife wanting food, Mr. Willoughby observed shrewdly.
Very astute of you, I said. Yes, I do want food. Do you suppose you could go and tell someone?
He dumped the healthy balls back into their bag at once and, springing to his feet, bowed deeply.
Humble servant, go now, he said,
and went, crashing rather heavily into the doorpost on his way out.
This was becoming ridiculous, I thought.
I harboured substantial doubt as to whether Mr. Willoughby's visit would result in food. He'd be lucky to make it to the bottom of the stair without falling on his head, if I was any judge of his condition. Rather than go on sitting here in the nude, receiving random deputations from the outside world, I thought it time to take steps. Rising and carefully wrapping a quilt around my body, I took a few out into the corridor. The upper floor seemed deserted. Aside from the room I had left, there were only two other doors up here. Glancing up, I could see unadorned rafters overhead. We were in the attic, then. Chances were that the other rooms here were occupied by servants, who were presumably now employed downstairs. I could hear faint noises drifting up the stairwell. Something else drifted up as well, the scent of frying sausage. A loud gustatory rumble informed me that my stomach hadn't missed this, and furthermore, that my innards considered the consumption of one peanut butter sandwich and one bowl of soup in one 24-hour period a wholly inadequate level of nutrition. I tucked the ends of the quilt in, sarong fashion, just above my breasts, and picking up my trailing skirts, followed the scent of food downstairs. The smell and the clinking, clattering, sloshing noises of a number of people eating were coming from a closed door on the first floor above ground level. I pushed it open and found myself at the end of a long room equipped as a refectory. The table was surrounded by 20-odd women, a few gowned for day, but most of them in a state of déshabille that made my quilt modest by comparison. A woman near the end of the table caught sight of me hovering in the doorway and beckoned,
companionably sliding over to make room for me on the end of the long bench.
"You'll be the new lass, eh?" she said. "You're a wee bit older than Madame usually takes on. She likes them no more than 25. You're no bad at all, though," she assured me hastily. "I'm sure you'll do fine."
"Good skin and a pretty face," observed the dark-haired lady across from us, sizing me up with the detached air of one appraising horseflesh. "And nice bubbies, what I can see." She lifted her chin slightly, peering across the table at what could be seen of my cleavage.
"Madame doesna like us to take the kivers off the beds," my original acquaintance said reprovingly. "You should wear your shift if you havena something pretty to show yourself in yet."
"Aye, and be careful with the quilt," advised the dark-haired girl, still scrutinising me.
"Madame'll dock your wages and you get spots on the bedclothes." "What's your name, my dearie?"
A short, rather plump girl with a round, friendly face leaned past the dark girl's elbow to smile at me.
"Here we're all chattering at you and not welcome you proper at all. I'm Dorcas. This is Peggy."
She jerked a thumb at the dark-haired girl, then pointed across the table to the fair-haired woman beside me.
"And that's Molly."
"My name's Claire," I said, smiling, and hitching the quilt a bit higher in self-consciousness. I wasn't sure how to correct their impression that I was Madame Jeanne's newest recruit. For the moment, that seemed less important than getting some breakfast. Apparently divining my need, the friendly Dorcas reached to the sideboard behind her, passed me a wooden plate, and shoved a large dish of sausages in my direction. The food was well cooked, and would have been good in any case. Starved as I was, it was ambrosial. A hell of a lot better than the hospital cafeteria's breakfast, I observed to myself, taking another ladle of fried potatoes.
"Had a rough one for your first, eh?"
Molly, next to me, nodded at my bosom. Glancing down, I was mortified to see a large red patch peeking above the edge of my quilt. I couldn't see my neck, but the direction of Molly's interested gaze made it clear that the small tingling sensations there were evidence of further bite marks.
"Your nose is a wee bit puffed too," Peggy said, frowning at me critically.
She reached across the table to touch it, disregarding the fact that the gesture caused her flimsy wrap to fall open to the waist.
"Slap you, did he? If they get too rough, you should call out, you know. Madam doesn't allow her customers to mistreat us. Give a good screech and Bruno will be there in a moment."
"Bruno," I said, a little faintly.
"The porter," Dorcas explained, busily spooning eggs into her mouth. "Big as a bear. That's why we call him Bruno." "What's his name, really?" she asked the table at large. "Horace?" "Theobald," corrected Molly.
She turned to call to a serving maid at the end of the room.
"Janie, will you fetch in more ale? The new lassie's had none yet." "Aye, Peggy's right," she said, turning back to me. She wasn't at all pretty, but had a nicely shaped mouth and a pleasant expression. "If you get a man likes to play a bit rough, that's one thing, and don't sick Bruno on a good customer, or there'll be hell to pay and you'll do the paying. But if you think you might really be damaged, then just give a good skelch. Bruno's never far away during the night. Oh, here's the ale," she added, taking a big pewter mug from the serving maid and plonking it in front of me. "She's no damaged," Dorcas said, having completed her survey of the visible aspects of my person. "A bit sore between the legs, though, eh?"
she said shrewdly, grinning at me.
"Oh, look, she's blushing," said Molly, giggling with delight. "Oh, you are a fresh one, aren't you?"
I took a deep gulp of the ale. It was dark, rich, and extremely welcome, as much for the width of the cup rim that hid my face as for its taste.
"Never mind," Molly patted my arm kindly. "After breakfast I'll show you where the tubs are. You can soak your parts in warm water and they'll be as good as new by tonight." "Be sure to show her where the jars are too," put in Dorcas. "Sweet herbs," she explained to me. "Put them in the water before you sit in it. Madame likes us to smell sweet. If the men want to lie with a fish, they would go to the docks. It is more cheap,
Peggy intoned in what was patently meant to be an imitation of Madame Jeanne. The table erupted in giggles, which were rapidly quelled by the sudden appearance of Madame herself, who entered through a door at the end of the room. Madame Jeanne was frowning in a worried fashion, and seemed too preoccupied to notice the smothered hilarity. Murmured Molly, seeing the proprietor. An early customer. I hate it when they come in the middle of breakfast, she grumbled.
Stop your digesting your food proper, it does. You needn't worry, Molly. It's Claire'll have to take him, Peggy said, tossing her dark plait out of the way. Newest lass takes the ones no one wants, she informed me. Stick your finger up his bum, Dorcas advised me. That brings him off faster than anything. I'll save your bannock for after, if you like.
Ah, thanks, I said. Just then, Madame Jeanne's eye lit upon me, and her mouth dropped open in a horrified, oh.
What are you doing here?
She hissed, rushing up to grab me by the arm.
Eating, I said, in no mood to be snatched at.
I detached my arm from her grasp and picked up my ale cup.
Merde, she said. Did no one bring you food this morning?
No, I said. Nor yet clothes. I gestured at the quilt, which was in imminent danger of falling off.
Nez de Cléopâtre, she said violently.
She stood up and glanced around the room, eyes flashing daggers.
I will have the worthless scum of a maid flayed for this. 1,000 apologies, madame.
That's quite all right, I said graciously, aware of the looks of astonishment on the faces of my breakfast companions. I've had a wonderful meal.
Nice to have met you all, ladies, I said, rising and doing my best to bow graciously while clutching my quilt. Now, madame, about my gown.
Amid Madame Jeanne's agitated protestations of apology and reiterated hopes that I wouldn't find it necessary to tell Monsieur Fraser that I had been exposed to an undesirable intimacy with the working members of the establishment, I made my clumsy way up 2 more flights of stairs and into a small room draped with hanging garments in various stages of completion, with bolts of cloth stacked here and there in the corners of the chamber.
A moment, please, Madame Jeanne said,
and with a deep bow left me to the company of a dressmaker's dummy with a large number of pins protruding from its stuffed bosom. Apparently this was where the costuming of the inmates took place. I walked around the room, quilt trailing, and observed several flimsy silk wrappers under construction, together with a couple of elaborate gowns with very low necks, and a number of rather imaginative variations on the basic shift and camisole. I removed one shift from its hook and put it on. It was made of fine cotton, with a low gathered neck, and embroidery in the form of multiple hands that curled enticingly under the bosom and down the sides of the waist, spreading out into a rakish caress atop the hips. It hadn't been hemmed, but was otherwise complete, and gave me a great deal more freedom of movement than had the quilt. I could hear voices in the next room, where Madame was apparently haranguing Bruno, or so I deduced the identity of the male rumble.
"I do not care what the miserable girl's sister has done," she was saying. "Do you not realize that the wife of Monsieur Jemmy was left naked and starving?" "Are you sure she's his wife?" the deep male voice asked. "I had heard." "So had I. But if he says this woman is his wife, I am not disposed to argue, n'est-ce pas?"
Madame sounded impatient.
"Now, as to this wretched Madeleine..." "It's not her fault, madame," Bruno broke in. "Have you not heard the news this morning about the fiend?"
Madame gave a small gasp.
"No, not another."
"Yes, madame."
Bruno's voice was grim.
"No more than a few doors away, above the Green Owl Tavern. The girl was Madeleine's sister. The priest brought the news just before breakfast, so you can see..."
"Yes, I see." Madame sounded a little breathless.
"Yes, of course, of course. Was it the same?"
Her voice quivered with distaste.
"Yes, madame," a hatchet or a big knife of some sort."
He lowered his voice, as people do when recounting horrid things.
"The priest told me that her head had been completely severed. Her body was near the door of her room, and her head..."
His voice dropped even lower, almost to a whisper.
"Her head was sitting on the mantelpiece looking into the room. The landlord swooned when he found her."
A heavy thud from the next room suggested that Madame Jeanne had done likewise. Gooseflesh rippled up my arms, and my own knees felt a trifle watery. I was beginning to agree with Jamie's fear that his installing me in a house of prostitution had been injudicious. At any rate, I was now clad, if not entirely dressed, and I went into the room next door to find Madame Jeanne in semi-recline on the sofa of a small parlour, with a burly, unhappy-looking man sitting on the hassock near her feet. Madame started up at the sight of me. "Madame Fraser! Oh, I'm so sorry. I did not mean to leave you waiting, but I have had..." She hesitated, looking for some delicate expression, some distressing news.
"I'd say so," I said. "What's this about a fiend?"
"You heard?" She was already pale. Now her complexion went a few shades whiter, and she wrung her hands.
"What will he say? He will be furious," she moaned.
"Who?" I asked. "Jamie or the fiend?"
"Your husband," she said.
She looked about the parlour, distracted.
"When he hears that his wife has been so shamefully neglected, mistaken for a fille de joie, and exposed to...
"I really don't think he'll mind," I said.
"But I would like to hear about the fiend."
"You would?"
Bruno's heavy eyebrows rose. He was a big man, with sloping shoulders and long arms that made him look rather like a gorilla, a resemblance enhanced by a low brow and a receding chin. He looked eminently suited to the role of a bouncer in a brothel.
"Well,"
he hesitated, glancing at Madame Jeanne for guidance, but the proprietor caught sight of the small enamelled clock on the mantelpiece and jumped to her feet with an exclamation of shock.
"Cordon!" she exclaimed. "I must go."
And with no more than a perfunctory wave in my direction, she sped from the room, leaving Bruno and me looking after her in surprise.
"Oh," he said, recovering himself. "That's right. It was coming at 10 o'clock.
It was 10:15 by the enamel clock. Whatever it was, I hoped it would wait.
"Fiend," I prompted.
Like most people, Bruno was only too willing to reveal all the gory details, once past a pro forma demur, for the sake of social delicacy. The Edinburgh fiend was, as I had deduced from the conversation thus far, a murderer. Like an early-day Jack the Ripper, he specialised in women of easy virtue, whom he killed with blows from a heavy-bladed instrument. In some cases, the bodies had been dismembered, or otherwise interfered with, as Bruno said in a lowered voice. The killings, 8 in all, had occurred at intervals over the last 2 years. With one exception, the women had been killed in their own rooms. Most lived alone. 2 had been killed in brothels. Hence Madame's agitation, I supposed.
"What was the exception?" I asked.
Bruno crossed himself.
"A nun,"
he whispered, the words evidently still a shock to him.
"A French sister of mercy."
The sister, coming ashore at Edinburgh with a group of nuns bound for London, had been abducted from the docks without any of her companions noticing her absence in the confusion. By the time she was discovered in one of Edinburgh's wines, after nightfall, it was too late. "Raped?" I asked with clinical interest. Bruno eyed me with considerable suspicion.
"I do not know," he said formally.
He rose heavily to his feet, his simian shoulders drooping with fatigue. I supposed he had been on duty all night. It must be his bedtime now.
"If you will excuse me, madame," he said,
with remote formality, and went out. I sat back on the small velvet sofa, feeling mildly dazed. Somehow, I hadn't realised that quite so much went on in brothels in the daytime. There was a sudden loud hammering at the door. It didn't sound like knocking, but as though someone really were using a metal-headed hammer to demand admittance. I got to my feet to answer the summons, but without further warning the door burst open and a slender, imperious figure strode into the room, speaking French in an accent so pronounced and an attitude so furious that I couldn't follow it at all. "Are you looking for Madame Jeanne?" I managed to put in, seizing a small pause when he stopped to draw breath for more invective. The visitor was a young man of about 30, slightly built and strikingly handsome, with thick black hair and brows. He glared at me under these, and as he got a good look at me, an extraordinary change went across his face. The brows rose, his black eyes grew huge, and his face went white. "Milady!" he exclaimed, and flung himself on his knees, embracing me about the thighs as he pressed his face into the cotton shift at crotch level. "Let go!" I exclaimed, shoving at his shoulders to detach him. "I don't work here. Let go, I say." "Milady," he was repeating in tones of rapture, "Milady, you have come back. A miracle. God has restored you." He looked up at me, smiling as tears streamed down his face. He had large, white, perfect teeth. Suddenly, memory stirred and shifted, showing me the outlines of an urchin's face beneath the man's bold visage. "Fergus," I said. "Fergus, is that really you? Get up, for God's sake. Let me see you." He rose to his feet, but didn't pause to let me inspect him. He gathered me into a rib-cracking hug, and I clutched him in return, pounding his back in the excitement of seeing him again. He had been 10 or so when I last saw him, just before Culloden. Now he was a man, and the stubble of his beard rasped against my cheek.
"I thought I was seeing a ghost," he exclaimed. "Is it really you, then?"
"Yes, it's me," I assured him.
"You have seen Milor?" he asked excitedly. "He knows you are here?"
"Yes."
"Oh."
He blinked and stepped back half a pace as something occurred to him.
But what about...
He paused, clearly confused. "What about what?"
"There you are. What in the name of God are you doing up here, Fergus?"
Jamie's tall figure loomed suddenly in the doorway. His eyes widened at the sight of me in my embroidered shift.
"Where are your clothes?" he asked. "Never mind," he said then, waving his hand impatiently as I opened my mouth to answer. "I haven't a time just now. Come along, Fergus. There's 18 anchors of brandy in the alleyway and the exciseman on my heels."
And with a thunder of boots on the wooden staircase, they were gone, leaving me alone once more. I wasn't sure whether I should join the party downstairs or not, but curiosity got the better of discretion. After a quick visit to the sewing room in search of more extensive covering, I made my way down, a large shawl half-embroidered with hollyhocks flung round my shoulders. I had gathered only a vague impression of the layout of the house the night before, but the street noises that filtered through the windows made it clear which side of the building faced the high street. I assumed the alleyway to which Jamie had referred must be on the other side, but wasn't sure. The houses of Edinburgh were frequently constructed with odd little wings and twisting walls to take advantage of every inch of space. I paused on the large landing at the foot of the stairs, listening for the sound of rolling casks as a guide. As I stood there, I felt a sudden draught on my bare feet and turned to see a man standing in the open doorway from the kitchen. He seemed as surprised as I was, but after blinking at me, he smiled and stepped forward to grip me by the elbow.
"And a good morning to you, my dear. I didn't expect to find any of you ladies up and about so early in the morning."
"Well, you know what they say about early to bed and early to rise," I said, trying to extricate my elbow. He laughed, showing rather badly stained teeth in a narrow jaw.
"No,
What do they say about it?
Well, it's something they say in America, come to think of it, I replied, suddenly realizing that Benjamin Franklin, even if currently publishing, probably didn't have a wide readership in Edinburgh.
Got a wit about you, Chucky, he said, with a slight smile. Send you down as a decoy, did she?
No. Who? I said.
The madam, he said, glancing around. Where is she?
I have no idea, I said.
Let go.
Instead, he tightened his grip so that his fingers dug uncomfortably into the muscles of my upper arm. He leaned closer, whispering in my ear with a gust of stale tobacco fumes.
There's a reward, you know,
he murmured confidentially.
A percentage of the value of the seized contraband. No one would need to know but you and me.
He flicked one finger gently under my breast, making the nipple stand up under the thin cotton.
What'd you say, Chuck?
I stared at him.
The excisemen are on my heels, Jamie had said.
This must be one, then. An officer of the Crown charged with the prevention of smuggling and the apprehension of smugglers. What had Jamie said? The pillory, transportation, flogging, imprisonment, ear-nailing, waving an airy hand as though such penalties were the equivalent of a traffic ticket. Whatever are you talking about? I said, trying to sound puzzled. And for the last time, let go of me. He couldn't be alone, I thought. How many others were there around the building?
Yes. Please let go, said a voice behind me.
I saw the exciseman's eyes widen as he glanced over my shoulder. Mr. Willoughby stood on the second stair in rumpled blue silk, a large pistol gripped in both hands. He bobbed his head politely at the excise officer.
Not stinking whore, he explained, blinking owlishly. Honourable wife.
The exciseman, clearly startled by the unexpected appearance of a Chinese, gawked from me to Mr. Willoughby and back again.
Wife, he said disbelievingly. You say she's your wife?
Mr. Willoughby, clearly catching only the salient word, nodded pleasantly.
Wife, he said again. Please letting go.
His eyes were mere bloodshot slits, and it was apparent to me, if not to the exciseman, that his blood was still approximately 80 proof. The exciseman pulled me toward himself and scowled at Mr. Willoughby.
Now listen here, he began.
He got no further, for Mr. Willoughby, evidently assuming that he had given fair warning, raised the pistol and pulled the trigger. There was a loud crack, an even louder shriek, which must have been mine, and the landing was filled with a cloud of grey powder smoke. The exciseman staggered back against the panelling, a look of intense surprise on his face, and a spreading rosette of blood on the breast of his coat. Moving by reflex, I leapt forward and grasped the man under the arms, easing him gently down to the floorboards of the landing. There was a flurry of noise from above as the inhabitants of the house crowded, chattering and exclaiming, onto the upper landing, attracted by the shot. Bounding footsteps came up the lower stairs, two at a time. Fergus burst through what must be the cellar door, a pistol in his hand.
"Milady!" he gasped,
catching sight of me sitting in the corner with the exciseman's body sprawled across my lap.
"What have you done?"
"Me?" I said indignantly. "I haven't done anything. It's Jamie's pet Chinaman." I nodded briefly toward the stair where Mr. Willoughby, the pistol dropped unregarded by his feet, had sat down on the step and was now regarding the scene below with a benign and bloodshot eye. Fergus said something in French that was too colloquial to translate, but sounded highly uncomplimentary to Mr. Willoughby. He strode across the landing and reached out a hand to grasp the little Chinaman's shoulder, or so I assumed, until I saw that the arm he extended didn't end in a hand, but in a hook of gleaming dark metal.
Fergus!
I was so shocked at the sight that I stopped my attempts to staunch the exciseman's wound with my shawl.
What?
I said incoherently.
What?
He said, glancing at me. Then, following the direction of my gaze, said,
Oh, that,
and shrugged.
The English.
Don't worry about it, milady. We haven't time. You, canaille, get downstairs.
He jerked Mr. Willoughby off the stairs, dragged him to the cellar door, and shoved him through it with a callous disregard for safety. I could hear a series of bumps suggesting that the Chinese was rolling downstairs, his acrobatic skills having temporarily deserted him, but had no time to worry about it. Fergus squatted next to me and lifted the exciseman's head by the hair.
"How many companions are with you?" he demanded. "Tell me quickly, cochon, or I slit your throat."
From the evident signs, this was a superfluous threat. The man's eyes were already glazing over. With considerable effort, the corners of his mouth drew back in a smile.
"I'll see you burn in hell," he whispered,
and with a last convulsion that fixed the smile in a hideous rictus upon his face, he coughed up a startling quantity of bright red foamy blood and died in my lap.
More feet were coming up the stairs at a high rate of speed. Jamie charged through the cellar door and barely stopped himself before stepping on the excise officer's trailing legs.
His eyes travelled up the body's length and rested on my face with horrified amazement.
"What have you done, Sassenach?" he demanded.
"Not her. The yellow pox,"
Fergus put in, saving me the trouble. He thrust the pistol into his belt and offered me his real hand.
"Come, milady, you must get downstairs."
Jamie forestalled him, bending over me as he jerked his head in the direction of the front hall.
"I'll manage here," he said. "Guard the front, Fergus. The usual signal. And keep your pistol hidden, unless there's need."
Fergus nodded and vanished at once through the door to the hall. Jamie had succeeded in bundling the corpse awkwardly in the shawl. He lifted it off me, and I scrambled to my feet, greatly relieved to be rid of it, in spite of the blood and other objectionable substances soaking the front of my shift.
"Ooh, I think he's dead,"
an awestruck voice floated down from above, and I looked up to see a dozen prostitutes peering down like cherubim from on high.
"Get back to your rooms," Jamie barked.
There was a chorus of frightened squeals, and they scattered like pigeons.
Jamie glanced round the landing for traces of the incident, but luckily there were none. The shawl and I had caught everything.
"Come on," he said.
The stairs were dim, and the cellar at the foot pitch black. I stopped at the bottom, waiting for Jamie. The exciseman hadn't been lightly built, and Jamie was breathing hard when he reached me.
"Across to the far side," he said, gasping. "A false wall. Hold my arm."
With the door above shut, I couldn't see a thing. Luckily, Jamie seemed able to steer by radar. He led me unerringly past large objects that I bumped in passing, and finally came to a halt. I could smell damp stone, and putting out a hand, felt a rough wall before me.
Jamie said something loudly in Gaelic. Apparently, it was the Celtic equivalent of "open sesame," for there was a short silence, then a grating noise, and a faint glowing line appeared in the darkness before me. The line widened into a slit, and a section of the wall swung out, revealing a small doorway made of a wooden framework, upon which cut stones were mounted, so as to look like part of the wall. The concealed cellar was a large room, at least 30 feet long. Several figures were moving about, and the air was ripely suffocating with the smell of brandy. Jamie dumped the body unceremoniously in a corner, then turned to me.
"God, Sassenach, are you all right?"
The cellar seemed to be lighted with candles dotted here and there in the dimness.
I could just see his face, skin drawn tight across his cheekbones.
"I'm a little cold," I said, trying not to let my teeth chatter. "My shift is soaked with blood. Otherwise, I'm all right, I think."
"Jeanne!"
He turned and called toward the far end of the cellar, and one of the figures came toward us, resolving itself into a very worried-looking madam.
He explained the situation in a few words, causing the worried expression to grow considerably worse.
"Horreur!" she cried. "Killed! On my premises! With witnesses?"
"Aye, I'm afraid so."
Jamie sounded calm.
"I'll manage about it. But in the meantime, you must go up. He might not have been alone. You'll know what to do."
His voice held a tone of calm assurance, and he squeezed her arm. The touch seemed to calm her. I hoped that was why he had done it. And she turned to leave.
"Oh, and Jeanne," Jamie called after her. "When you come back, can you bring down some clothes for my wife? If her gown's not ready, I think Daphne is maybe the right size."
"Clothes?"
Madame Jeanne squinted into the shadows where I stood. I helpfully stepped out into the light, displaying the results of my encounter with the exciseman. Madame Jeanne blinked once or twice, crossed herself, and turned without a word to disappear through the concealed doorway, which swung to behind her with a muffled thud. I was beginning to shake, as much with reaction as with the cold. Accustomed as I was to emergency, blood, and even sudden death, the events of the morning had been more than a little harrowing. It was like a bad Saturday night in the emergency room.
"Come along, Sassenach,"
Jamie said, putting a hand gently on the small of my back.
"We'll get you washed."
His touch worked on me as well as it had on Madame Jeanne. I felt instantly better, if still apprehensive.
"Washed? In what, brandy?"
He gave a slight laugh at that.
"No, water. I can offer ye a bathtub, but I'm afraid it'll be cold."
It was extremely cold.
Where did this water come from?" I asked, shivering.
The water gushed out of a pipe set in the wall, normally kept plugged with an insanitary-looking wad of rags, wrapped to form a rough seal around the chunk of wood that served as a plug. I pulled my hand out of the chilly stream and wiped it on the shift, which was too far gone for anything to make much difference. Jamie shook his head as he manoeuvred the big wooden tub closer to the spout.
"Off the roof," he answered. "There's a rainwater cistern up there. The guttering pipe runs down the side of the building, and the cistern pipe is hidden inside it."
He looked absurdly proud of himself, and I laughed. "Quite an arrangement," I said. "What do you use the water for?"
"To cut the liquor," he explained.
He gestured at the far side of the room, where the shadowy figures were working with notable industry among a large array of casks and tubs.
"It comes in 180 degrees above proof. We mix it here with pure water and recask it for sale to the taverns."
He shoved the rough plug back into the pipe and bent to pull the big tub across the stone floor.
"Here, we'll take it out of the way. They'll be needing the water."
One of the men was, in fact, standing by with a small cask clasped in his arms. With no more than a curious glance at me, he nodded to Jamie and thrust the cask beneath the stream of water.
This ends Disc 13. Voyager, Disc 14.
Behind a hastily arranged screen of empty barrels, I peered dubiously down into the depths of my makeshift tub. A single candle burned in a puddle of wax nearby, glimmering off the surface of the water and making it look black and bottomless. I stripped off, shivering violently, thinking that the comforts of hot water and modern plumbing had seemed a hell of a lot easier to renounce when they were close at hand. Jamie groped in his sleeve and pulled out a large handkerchief, at which he squinted dubiously.
"Aye, well, it's maybe cleaner than your shift," he said, shrugging.
He handed it to me, then excused himself to oversee operations at the other end of the room. The water was freezing, and so was the cellar, and as I gingerly sponged myself, the icy trickles running down my stomach and thighs brought on small fits of shivering. Thoughts of what might be happening overhead did little to ease my feelings of chilly apprehension. Presumably we were safe enough for the moment, so long as the false cellar wall deceived any searching exciseman. But if the wall failed to hide us, our position was all but hopeless. There appeared to be no way out of this room but by the door in the false wall, and if that wall were breached, we wouldn't only be caught red-handed in possession of quite a lot of contraband brandy, but also in custody of the body of a murdered king's officer. And surely the disappearance of that officer would provoke an intensive search. I had visions of excisemen combing the brothel, questioning and threatening the women, emerging with complete descriptions of myself, Jamie, and Mr. Willoughby, as well as several eyewitness accounts of the murder. Involuntarily, I glanced at the far corner where the dead man lay beneath his blood-stained shroud, covered with pink and yellow hollyhocks. The Chinaman was nowhere to be seen, having apparently passed out behind the anchors of brandy.
"Here, Sassenach, drink this. Your teeth are chattering so. You're likely to bite through your tongue."
Jamie had reappeared by my seal hole like a St. Bernard dog bearing a firkin of brandy. Thanks. I had to drop the washcloth and use both hands to steady the wooden cup so it wouldn't clack against my teeth. But the brandy helped. It dropped like a flaming coal into the pit of my stomach and sent small curling tendrils of warmth through my frigid extremities as I sipped. "Oh, God, that's better," I said, stopping long enough to gasp for breath. "Is this the uncut version?"
"No, that would likely kill you. This is maybe a little stronger than what we sell, though. Finish up and put something on, then you can have a bit more."
Jamie took the cup from my hand and gave me back the handkerchief washcloth. As I hurriedly finished my chilly ablutions, I watched him from the corner of my eye. He was frowning as he gazed at me, clearly deep in thought. I had imagined that his life was complicated. It hadn't escaped me that my presence was undoubtedly complicating it a good bit more. I would have given a lot to know what he was thinking. "What are you thinking about, Jamie?" I said, watching him sidelong as I swabbed the last of the smudges from my thighs. The water swirled around my calves, disturbed by my movements, and the candlelight lit the waves with sparks, as though the dark blood I had washed from my body now glowed once more live and red in the water. The frown vanished momentarily as his eyes cleared and fixed on my face.
"I'm thinking that you're very beautiful, Sassenach," he said softly.
"Maybe if one has a taste for goose flesh on a large scale," I said tartly, stepping out of the tub and reaching for the cup.
He grinned suddenly at me, teeth flashing white in the dimness of the cellar.
"Oh, aye," he said. "Well, you're speaking to the only man in Scotland who has a terrible cockstand at the sight of a plucked chicken."
I spluttered in my brandy and choked, half hysterical from tension and terror. Jamie quickly shrugged out of his coat and wrapped the garment around me, hugging me close against him as I shivered and coughed and gasped.
"Makes it hard to pass a poulterer's stall and stay decent," he murmured in my ear, briskly rubbing my back through the fabric. "Hush, Sassenach, hush now. It'll be fine."
I clung to him, shaking. "I'm sorry," I said. "I'm all right. It's my fault, though. Mr. Willoughby shot the exciseman because he thought he was making indecent advances to me."
Jamie snorted. "That doesn't make it your fault, Sassenach," he said dryly. "And for what it's worth, it's no the first time the Chinaman's done something foolish either. When he's drink taken, he'll do anything, and never mind how mad it is."
Suddenly, Jamie's expression changed as he realised what I had said. He stared down at me, eyes wide.
"Did you say exciseman, Sassenach?"
"Yes. Why?" He didn't answer, but let go my shoulders and whirled on his heel, snatching the candle off the cask in passing. Rather than be left in the dark, I followed him to the corner where the corpse lay under its shawl.
"Hold this."
Jamie thrust the candle unceremoniously into my hand and knelt by the shrouded figure,
pulling back the stained fabric that covered the face. I had seen quite a few dead bodies. The sight was no shock, but it still wasn't pleasant. The eyes had rolled up beneath half-closed lids, which did nothing to help the generally ghastly effect. Jamie frowned at the dead face, drop-jawed and waxy in the candlelight, and muttered something under his breath. "What's wrong?" I asked. I had thought I would never be warm again, but Jamie's coat was not only thick and well-made, it held the remnants of his own considerable body heat. I was still cold, but the shivering had eased.
"This isn't an exciseman," Jamie said, still frowning. "I know all the riding officers in the district, and the superintending officers too, but I've not seen this fellow before."
With some distaste, he turned back the sodden flap of the coat and groped inside. He felt about gingerly but thoroughly inside the man's clothing, emerging at last with a small penknife and a small booklet bound in red paper. "New Testament," I read with some astonishment. Jamie nodded, looking up at me with one brow raised.
"Exciseman or no, it seems a peculiar thing to bring with you to a kittle hussy."
He wiped the little booklet on the shawl, then drew the folds of the fabric quite gently back over the face, and rose to his feet, shaking his head.
"That's the only thing in his pockets. Any customs inspector or exciseman must carry his warrant upon his person at all times, for otherwise he's no authority to carry out a search of premises or seize goods."
He glanced up, eyebrows raised.
"Why did you think he was an exciseman?"
I hugged the folds of Jamie's coat around myself, trying to remember what the man had said to me on the landing. He asked me whether I was a decoy and where the madam was. Then he said that there was a reward, a percentage of seized contraband. That's what he said. And that no one would know but him and me.
"And you'd said there were excisemen after you," I added. "So naturally I thought he was one." Then Mr. Willoughby turned up, and things rather went to pot.
Jamie nodded, still looking puzzled.
"Aye, well, I haven't got any idea who he is, but it's a good thing that he isn't an exciseman. I thought at first something had come very badly unstuck, but it's likely all right."
"Unstuck?" He smiled briefly.
"I have an arrangement with a superintending customs officer for the district, Sassenach."
I gaped at him. "Arrangement?" He shrugged.
"Well, bribery, then, if you'd like to be straight out about it."
He sounded faintly irritated.
"No doubt that's standard business procedure," I said, trying to sound tactful.
One corner of his mouth twitched slightly.
"Aye, it is. Well, in any case, there's an understanding, as you might say, between Sir Percival Turner and myself. And to find him sending excise officers into this place would worry me considerably."
"All right," I said slowly, mentally juggling all the half-understood events of the morning and trying to make a pattern of them. "But in that case, what did you mean by telling Fergus the excisemen were on your heels? And why has everyone been racing round like chickens with their heads off?"
"All that."
He smiled briefly and took my arm, turning me away from the corpse at our feet.
"Well, it's an arrangement, as I said. And part of it is that Sir Percival must satisfy his own masters in London by seizing sufficient amounts of contraband now and again. So we see to it that he's given the opportunity. Wally and the lads brought down two wagon loads from the coast, one of the best brandy and the other filled with spiled casks and the punked wine, topped off with a few anchors of cheap swell, just to give it all flavour. I met them just outside the city this morning, as we planned, and then we drove the wagons in, taking care to attract the attention of the riding officer, who just happened to be passing with a small number of dragoons. They came along, and we led them a canty chase through the alleyways until the time for me and the good tubs to part company with Wally and his load of swell. Wally jumped off his wagon then and made a war, and I drove like hell down here with two or three dragoons following, just for show, like. Luke's well in a report, you ken.
He grinned at me, quoting,
"The smugglers escaped in spite of industrious pursuit, but His Majesty's valiant soldiers succeeded in capturing an entire wagon load of spirits valued at £60 10s.